Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and we'll be with you for the next hour on this March the 6th on the West Coast or March the 7th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Also, we'd like to welcome all of you who come to listen to this show from various parts of the world, including those with the intelligence agencies. We've got a very important show for you this evening, which is a continuation of last week's show, and we'll be introducing our guest in a moment. Also got a very important news bite that was delivered to me about an hour before the show, and this concerns everyone. You know, for a number of years, there have been some people who have been broadcasting, lecturing, teaching, producing books and DVDs about this topic of RFID chips, or the radio frequency identification chips that sort of look like a kernel of rice that they plan injecting under your skin and your right hand, or somewhere underneath your hairline, wherever they can find a place to do that, for the purpose of tracking you. Now, they've been trying to introduce the concept by saying that some workers in Cincinnati a year or two ago made the courageous move, and they're so happy. Their quality of life has really changed because they've got this electronic rice kernel underneath their skin. And, of course, I'm being a bit sarcastic here, but think about that. Why would anyone be happy having a foreign substance put into their body? Now, this has been done for a number of years by veterinarians that are telling people, hey, we have a great method now. We can tag your dog underneath the skin, or your cat, your favorite pet, by placing one of these rice-sized chips underneath the skin. And these devices have been known to cause the death of animals, loved pets, some young, some older, and they tend to grow fibrous growth off of the chip and around that because of the electromagnetic radiation that is being emitted. It's not healthy. The purpose is to track you down like a GPS system, and it's a sign of how evil the powers that be have become, that this has actually been implemented. Now, I heard a story which is quite interesting. It occurred in the Huntington Internal Medicine Group's facility in Cable, I don't know how they pronounce it, they probably say Cable, County Hospital at Marshall University in West Virginia. This happened very recently to a patient that was there as a follow-up to some knee surgery. And there was a painkiller that had been prescribed and administered, and it was becoming addictive, and so this patient was being weaned off of the medication. And the patient waited an hour for the doctor to return when he said, I'll be back in a moment, and that moment became an hour. Patient wandered down the hall, virtually looking in every room, which most of which were empty, until the patient overheard a conversation at the end of the hallway amongst some doctors, and her doctor was describing, and to use a quote, we got our first order of RFID chips in today. So we're going to start giving them to people. And they're going to be giving them to newborns, and they're going to be giving them to people that probably are in some state of unconsciousness or in a coma, as well as the elderly. And this is rather troubling, and of course the patient voiced displeasure, and when the doctor did finally return to the room and made a comment to the effect of, you're not giving me one of those RFID chips. Now, it seems like the doctor's first response would have been, who said anything about that? But he said, oh, we're not going to give you one of those today. You don't have to do that today. So he was probably taken aback and shocked that she was aware of this, number one, and probably wondering how this person came upon this information at all. This is going on, and we feel it's important to alert you, not to frighten you, but be aware that if you have a loved one in a hospital or you yourself are going in for an operation or something, you're going to want to make sure that this procedure is not performed on you. And you might have to take some legal precautions to insist that it doesn't occur. Ultimately, if it's found within your body and without your consent, and I would say you should be able to get someone to draft an agreement or an order that it's not to be done. You have the choice to do it. Of course, if you want to be tracked, then by all means, don't let us stop you. This has been something that's been reported on by several experts. It was a featured portion of Aaron Russo's America, Freedom to Fascism movie that came out a couple of years ago. Aaron has passed away. In that movie, he interviewed Dr. Catherine Albrecht, who basically said that this is a plan that's underway. They're getting very itchy, and their trigger finger is itchy as well, because the truth is being revealed to the public, to people who listen to shows like this. They're uncomfortable with the truth coming out. There is cause for alarm on their part, and that means we're doing the right thing. We're not fear-mongering. We're letting you know that we're aware of where they are with this game they're playing. The next phase is underway. So take heed. Do the research. We're not asking you to believe this, but many times what we brought out on the show has come to pass, or where things have been hidden, we have exposed them and we've stopped catastrophes from happening. This is certainly a catastrophe, and I have too much respect for the listening audience and those that I don't even know around the world. We must beware. These people are insane. With that, and this is by no means a segue to my guest tonight. He is on every week, and he's probably cracking up right now just by the thought of what I just said. He is a scientist. He is an inventor, an author, a lecturer, and a teacher, and he is my regular Friday night guest on Evident Footprints, and I've been coining the phrase that he's our resident science advisor, and he couldn't have a better one than Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show again.
Well, thank you, Don, and thank you for that really extraordinary introduction, including the idea of linking me to the insanity.
Do you like that segue? Did that crack you up or what?
Well, I've been called worse.
What do you, just for a moment here, we're, you know, it's not our plan to dwell on this, but what's your impression of hearing that news?
Well, we all knew it was coming. The thing of it is, it really ticked me off. I'll tell you quite honestly, if I ever found out somebody put one of those darn things under my skin without my permission, not only would I cut it out myself if I had to, but I would I'd probably ram it up the guy's nose. You know, who the heck do they think they are anyway? You know, this is all an extension of the concept of chattel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the corporate United States got themselves in debt, and then to get out of debt, they usurped the entire population of the U.S. and all of its assets. You know, under the, I believe it's the 14th Amendment,
mm-hmm.
and made us all assureds for the debt. And, you know, that puts us in the category of chattel. And just because they pulled an illegal move to make that happen, then they start to believe that they really do own us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, I think the day is going to come when they find out who owns who around here.
Yeah, and I would agree with you and say that that day is very close at hand. So, well, thank you for that input on that wonderful topic. Maybe we can do a show.
It's very irritating. I mean, you know, it really is, because I grew up in an era where freedom was an entirely different thing than it's been reduced to today. And I'm very, very sensitive to my freedoms being taken away from me.
Yeah.
Much more so, perhaps, than some of the, you know, follow-on generations. So, you know, I get agitated.
Yeah. I had the opportunity to speak with D.V. Kidd this evening on the Rick Adams Show, and she referred to the government as it is as usurpers, and I agree wholeheartedly. In fact, I use that term in a piece that I'm working on right now. I'm going to talk about the number one usurper, and I've got evidence coming out to support what I have been writing about and talking about. If I was writing about everything I've uncovered, I would still be writing about it over and over and over, and I wouldn't even have a radio show to talk about it. So I've sort of struck a balance between the two and share some of my findings with the listening audience, but not everyone's listening to the show, so it does go into the writing. But there are certain elements that are worth bringing out, because we're seeing some of the characterizations I've made play out. Some of the characterizations you've made and others that have been on the show. We're seeing that we have not been exaggerating. We've not been misleading the public whatsoever. We're seeing this firsthand. Even the followers of these madmen are beginning to wake up. And it's only taken a month and a half. It's only taken a month and a half, $9 trillion spent. And these laws coming down, these policies that smack of the days of Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin and Karl Marx and on, it doesn't end. It's endless. These people are they've been driven in more insane by their own insanity. I don't know how else to describe it. And so, you know, I think we're pretty much in agreement on that. Now, on a lighter note, I know last week you were basically breezing through your outline of topics and points that you wanted to make, and I sort of steered us in a bunch of different directions, but we were basically laying a foundation for the topics that you wanted to cover, and I want to give you the opportunity to sort of give us a synopsis of what we discussed last week, followed by, you know, the continuation of this information that you want to share with our listening audience. Would you do that, Jim?
Of course. Basically, last week, and of course, it's difficult for me to hop all around because we did go off on several different tangents, but I was trying to give indication to the fact that there is a basic relationship between geometry and space, geometry and all of the forces that we know in the universe. And the geometry itself is essentially the language that the Creator used when he made everything.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to lead to was how this actually precipitates into things that we understand in our everyday life. Because once you see the continuity from the more obtuse or the more abstract areas down to the stuff we're familiar with in our everyday life, it literally gives you a ladder or a stairway for your consciousness to follow to a higher realm, which is kind of like what the Kabbalah was designed to do and some of these other mystic and ancient teachings of understanding. But this would be a really watered-down version that, you know, is based on on my personal observations over the years and the way I perceive reality, and it'd be reduced to the level where people can sort of grasp it and say, oh, yeah, I got the idea. Because once they start investing their mental energies in that direction, there will be an unfolding. There always is.
Yeah. Well, I took us down some different paths. I guess it was sort of a spontaneous process that occurred, because as you were revealing these different components of geometry, you and I had even discussed this prior to the show to some extent. And I mean, we really, you know, went into the stratosphere with what we were talking about. And I don't know. I felt in a sense that we should maybe touch upon some of the basics and spend a little bit of time. But the intention was not to slow you down, but to give us the opportunity to allow those that are hearing this sort of thing for the first time to grasp, you know, the fundamental concepts. So, be my guest, Jim.
Well, when we start to consider these things from the most fundamental concept, of course, when you have to consider nothing but space itself, we perceive it as a vast emptiness, even though it really isn't. But I mean, if it were truly devoid of all matter, it would be just some vast empty place. And it's very difficult to get a hook into what it's all about when you look at it that way. But for the sake of introducing these ideas, if we now take that vast emptiness and we stick a parcel of mass in the middle of that, we now have the most basic of the two building blocks from which most things in our level of consciousness flow. You have mass and you have distance. Now you might say, well, where does the distance come in? I mean, if I have this whole universe, I just stick one parcel of mass in the middle of it, where is the distance? Well, the interesting thing is the distance is wherever you want it to be. Because once you have mass situated somewhere, then from that point, you can now look out in an infinite number of directions and choose any distance you want. Mm-hmm. And the reason why this is interesting is because of the fact that this type of circumstance corresponds to causality, in the sense that you essentially begin with practically nothing, and from this is going to flow all the things that we understand. And I'm going to try to take you down that road in a very interesting way. Now, the situation I just described, where you have mass and any distance you want to consider, there is no time involved as we know it. There might be an ephemeral time, which has to do with the progression of aging of the universe itself, if in fact it is aging. But for the sake of this particular set of circumstances that I'm going to introduce, if you just have mass and distance, there is no time. And there doesn't need to be either. But then if we go to the next level of consciousness, pertaining to the same set of circumstances, except that we now allow the mass to be in motion. And as soon as we do that, we now have another order of complexity, because what we now have is momentum and distance. The mass is moving with a particular velocity, and it's going someplace along a particular ray of direction. So you've got momentum and distance. And that constitutes a very different set of circumstances, because once you introduce the velocity component, time is now implicit in the velocity. And this is one of the things that's really interesting about all this. Time isn't real in itself, and this shows up even in math. Concerning these investigations, when I say it's implicit, what I mean is that if something is moving at a particular velocity and it's moving with respect to a point that you want to establish as a starting or an ending or a passing point, those ingredients all by themselves suggest the existence of time. Because if I have a velocity and a distance, time is implied. Whether it's real or not is another story. But nonetheless, it's brought forth by that combination of events. And so then we move on to the next level of manifestation, and that would be force and distance. Now, force can be looked upon as the rate of change of momentum. So if we have momentum and distance, and now we introduce a rate of change of that momentum, which implies an acceleration, by the way, then we wind up with force and distance. And this is a concept which on our level of perception represents what we call work. And so in the idea of work, time is implicit again as a rate of change of velocity, which of course we call acceleration. And then there's one more level. There's actually several levels, but I'm only going to go one more because these are the things that people are mostly familiar with. The next level would be force and velocity, so that the distance is changing along with the momentum, and now you've got force and velocity, and this is what constitutes power. Okay, now you notice that energy doesn't even enter into the picture in the normal sequence of things, because it is an artificial construct that is, for all intents and purposes, used for accounting reasons. And it doesn't fit in the natural order of things in the way in which I'm introducing this series of this stratification, if you want to call it, of levels of consciousness. Now, when it comes to the utilization of geometry in conjunction with these various attributes, whether they be forces, accelerations, momentums, or what have you, the very fact that you're making these things combine produces effects which we have come to call machinery. And when we think of the word machine, you know, you might conjure up an internal combustion engine or an airplane or something like that in your mind, and that's okay. But in physics, there's really some very basic machines upon which all other machines are built by virtue of the fact that the simple machines are compounded into more complicated sets of order. And so what I wanted to do was to just introduce some of the most basic machines, because a lot of people don't realize that they're machines. The simplest one is the lever, perhaps. You know, if you take a long rod, like a crowbar, and you stick it against the fulcrum, which could be a log or something, you can lift or move a rock weighing hundreds and hundreds of pounds with a reasonably small force at the other end of the lever. Well, that entire arrangement constitutes a machine called a lever. And it's a very interesting machine because it essentially allows us to amplify force over distance. So when you move the huge rock, you'll find that you're moving at a relatively small distance with a very large force, but on your end of the lever, you're applying a small force, but you have to move it through a very large distance in order to ensure the displacement of the load. So that, believe it or not, constitutes a fundamental machine. Another fundamental machine, which is not paid much attention to, except maybe in high school physics, is the inclined plane. And an inclined plane is nothing more than a slope. So if you have a plank and you situate it between the back of a pickup truck and the ground, you actually have a machine. And the reason you have a machine is because of the fact that if I now roll a 55-gallon drum up that plank, it will be a lot easier for me to do that than it would be for me to pick the thing up with brute force and stick it on the back of the truck. And so, again, we're sacrificing effort for distance because the incline is essentially a triangle, which is, again, an expression of geometry, and the hypotenuse of the triangle is longer than either of the other two sides. And so when we roll the sparrow up the incline, there again, the force of gravity on the barrel is diluted, but we pay for it in a greater distance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another form of machine. And interestingly enough, if you wrap an inclined plane around a pole, you wind up with something that most people don't even know is a machine, and that's called a screw. And the screw is nothing more than an inclined plane bent into a helix. So it essentially does the same thing, except it goes around and around instead of going up in one straight shot. And, of course, another pretty basic piece of machinery is a block and tackle. If I have a rope that goes over a couple of pulleys and goes around two or three different times, it's a lot easier for me to lift a heavy object. But there again, the force that I'm applying to the rope is now applied over a much longer length because I have to take up an enormous amount of rope to move the block and tackle a very short distance. And so that constitutes another machine. I mean, you'll notice that these things all have some very basic concepts in common with each other. And the last one I'm going to touch upon is a simple set of gears. If I have a large gear and a small gear, I can have a mechanical advantage in the amount of effort that it takes me to twist the small gear against the large gear and get an amplification of torque to turn a particular angular load. So those are some examples of machines. The thing that's interesting about it is they all have some very interesting things in common: force, distance, and shape. And so we're back to the same fundamental things that we discussed in our hierarchy of consciousness, looking at the way the universe functions. You know, we have various manifestations of shape, and as we apply forces and other physical parameters to these shapes, we get various effects, most of which have to do with either work or power in our everyday lives, at least in the civilized world. And now, from that, we want to move on to something which is a little bit more complicated, just to give you an idea of how combinations of those basic machines build up when they are put together in various combinations and different arrangements for the sake of producing a specific effect. And we'll cover here several examples of complex geometric machines. Well, I mentioned one earlier, which of course would be the internal combustion engine. And if you think about that, I don't know how many of the listeners really know about an internal combustion engine, but there are a multitude of different basic machines all wrapped up into this one complicated thing with hundreds of parts. You've got gears, you've got screws, you've got levers, you've got all kinds of things going on in there. Another, which is a little bit more etheric, is the electric motor. An electric motor is a very interesting machine because physically it really makes use of just two circles, you might say, one representing the rotor and the other representing the stator. But the forces that cause one to turn with respect to the other are generated by invisible force fields. And those force fields are created electrically with a current flow and turns of wire. So that we now have magnetic forces which are acting to cause a torque which can then do work in the real world. So that's another interesting complex machine, and it involves geometry as well. Now we're going to get to something that's probably going to surprise a lot of people, but it's essential to understand this. Another complex machine which is based on geometry for its functionality is the atomic pile, or nuclear reactor, if you want to call it that. And it would be interesting if we could show pictures on this show, because it would clear this up to the satisfaction of most people. But the original atomic pile, which was put together in Chicago back during the Second World War, and in a laboratory at the Chicago University, I believe, headed up by Enrico Fermi, was essentially nothing more than a geometric arrangement of carbon bricks and uranium bricks that were arranged in a particular pattern. And there we have a perfect example of how geometry determines the outcome of the liberation of nuclear power, and the forces that are being applied in that instance are on the atomic level, but nonetheless, or the nuclear level, if you choose to use that term, but nonetheless, the control of those forces requires a geometric grid, if you will, in three dimensions that is a combination of uranium fuel. And in those days, I think they used the uranium 238 and carbon or graphite. And the graphite actually serves to moderate or slow down neutrons, which are coming out of the uranium isotope, and allow them to be reabsorbed by other uranium atoms so that they can undergo fusion. And this whole process, which looks very innocent, just sitting there, releases huge amounts of atomic energy by virtue of a geometric arrangement and, of course, an in-depth understanding of the forces involved. Now, we can take this to one or two other levels, which are pretty interesting. The next one that comes to mind, which, of course, is one of my favorites, and yours too, Don, is the Great Pyramid. Now, we all know that the Great Pyramid has very astounding forces associated with it, and there's no moving parts, there's no radioisotopes, there's no nothing, just shape.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really astounding when you stop to think of it, because the energies that are being tapped in that instance is the life force that operates within the biosphere of our planet. But nonetheless, it's a machine. And it's the last thing that you would think of as a machine, because it's just a beautiful structure.
Mm-hmm.
But it fills the basic definition. Now, another thing that most people don't look upon as a machine, but which certainly is one, and that is our planet Earth. It's a sphere, and it's just sitting there in space, and we're all living on it, and we don't look upon it as being a machine. But it's a geometric shape of a very specific type of sphere, or a spheroid, and it's has many different components that most people don't consider. And it has a function. Okay, it's like our life support system that allows us to live out our lives in this closed ecosystem, and go about, you know, the basic function that the Creator has supplied for us and the other creatures that live here. But it is definitely a machine of a very sophisticated design. So those are the kinds of things that I wanted to introduce with respect to supplying some background and some hierarchy, if you will, of information regarding the way in which things seem to be ordered in the universe, Don.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting and very comprehensive what you just presented. If I could make a comment on what you said, and you know my interest in the pyramids, and we're not talking necessarily about this cult phenomenon of pyramidology, but we're getting at the heart of what the technology, what the geometry reveals. In a very mystical yet explainable way in terms of science, and it's the use of these sacred numbers which produce ratios which require specific parameters. In other words, you've seen all types of pyramids created by people, and you know, three-sided pyramids, and four-sided pyramids using equilateral triangles as the measurement for the four sides, let's say. Yet that doesn't necessarily mean that these sacred numbers are there. In fact, if you are using an equilateral triangle, you are not getting the certain measurements that would cause these metaphysical or these scientifically measurable results and phenomenon that occur. Some people are saying, what do you mean phenomenon? Well, there's the mummification or the exclusion of bacteria. Bacteria cannot grow within the shape of a true pyramid. You can sharpen razor blades. You can change the molecular structure of things that are put in it to preserve them, so they a true pyramid shape becomes the perfect bread box, let's say, or the perfect food storage container, and it not only affects physical objects but objects that cannot be seen. It affects the mental capacity of one's physiology and how the thought processes are enhanced. It affects one's creativity. There's just an endless list of possibilities with what that structure itself, which is basically four triangles leaning up against each other, but having a specific parameter requiring a specific measurement of the apex and its relationship to the circle. Would you expound on that a little bit, if that's not off track for what you
it's not off track. I don't mind expounding on it. What you're hinting at, of course, is the fact that the Great Pyramid is designed in such a way that it relates back to the phi parameter. And phi is a number. It is actually one of the roots of a quadratic equation which satisfies the relationship x squared is equal to x plus 1. If you stop and think about that, it's a very, very interesting statement, because what it's saying is that there is a number which exists that if I square that number or add 1 to it, I get the same result. Mm-hmm. Now, mathematically, that's odd enough. But when you actually apply the geometry to that circumstance, now you get some insight into something that's really peculiar, because what the equation says basically is that if I have a unit of square area based on phi, then I can represent that unit of square area without any numerical error in a linear length, and that length is going to be equal to the phi parameter plus 1, which means that I will have a linear measurement which is uniquely equal mathematically to a unit of square measurement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, upon superficial inspection, that doesn't sound like anything so wonderful. But let's take it to the next level of complexity, that if we use the same ratios and look at this from a higher level of understanding, what it also implies is that if I have a volume based on phi, that volume can be rigorously represented by a unit of square area, which will have the same mathematical properties in two dimensions as the area of cubic measurement has in three. And then we'll take it one more step and say, it also implies that if we have a four-dimensional space based on phi, that it can be represented without error in the construction of a three-dimensional room based on the same numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we suddenly have something which nobody really likes to hear about, but it's staring you right in the face. And that is, we have a three-dimensional room with a rectangular shape that's based on the golden mean, or phi, but that room is numerically equal to a four-dimensional space. And so if it's numerically equal, or if they are true equivalents of one another, what happens to things that are in that space?
Yeah, subjected. Aren't they subjected to the fourth dimension then, or fourth dimensional properties?
Well, of course, that's the whole point. Even though they're in a three-dimensional room, they now have access to whatever happens in the fourth dimension.
Yes.
Now, what's interesting about this is that the little despot, Napoleon Bonaparte, after he conquered Egypt, he had a great interest in Egyptian antiquity. And one of the things that he heard about was the fact that the Great Pyramid had occult forces associated with its design.
Mm-hmm.
And he was determined to find out if there was any truth to that. And so he literally slept in the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid one night to see if anything interesting would happen. And when they reclaimed him the next morning, he was in a very bad state, and he refused to talk about what happened. And it wasn't until he was on his deathbed that he ever mentioned the experience again. And when people who were present as he was dying asked him, well, what did happen to you in there? He just looked at them and said, you'd never believe me. And he died without revealing the secret. The thing that's interesting about all this is that if you ask the Egyptians themselves about the structure or read the pyramid texts to talk about this stuff, basically what it implies is that the Great Pyramid was never designed to be a tomb or a coffin. The purpose of the sarcophagus was that an initiate would be placed inside that thing and allowed to have a ritual form of death without losing the life force from his physical body. And he was therefore carried into the cosmos on a spiritual level and allowed to experience things that you normally cannot experience without dying. And so here we have a machine. It's not only a geometric expression of something really incredible, but it is tying into forces of a spiritual nature, because the mathematics that it's based on links this world to another.
Yes.
And that's a pretty awesome thing to suggest.
Yeah. Now, you were talking about phi, and I alluded to it in this sacred measurement. These for those that are unaware, sacred measurements don't end. They keep continuing on to infinity. So even though, I mean, this is sort of philosophizing or hypothecating in a sense, but when a physical structure appears to end, and yet there's an aspect of it that is fourth dimensional, if we are a three-dimensional being and our senses are three-dimensional, without any kind of raising of the consciousness, that might cause us to understand or to even account for the possibility that this is another reality that can be experienced. It's difficult for people to imagine that a structure that appears to end in a three-dimensional context can keep on going on to infinity. For instance, let me say this: if that measurement, that sacred measurement of the apex of the pyramid is unending, then at the point where all four of the intersecting lines meet, they could continue at that same trajectory into space, creating another pyramid invisible on top of it. In other words, point to point. Could it not? I mean, that's not an impossibility.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the geometry is existing irrespective of, you know, the physical materials from which it is made.
Yeah, it's free. In other words, it's free to exist whether or not you see it. Certainly, if you were standing in front of the pyramid and went to sleep, you wouldn't see it. It doesn't make the pyramid go away.
So, I mean, you could very well argue the point that it might have invisible components by virtue of laws of mathematics, which are not normally given any credence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, getting back to what you said earlier, which is really a very insightful thing, this whole concept of the idea between geometry and mathematics is well expounded in a very, very simple geometric relationship. If we have a triangle that has an altitude of 1 unit and a base of 1 unit, you don't have to be a real bright mathematician to figure out that the hypotenuse is going to have a length equivalent to radical 2, or the square root of 2. Now, the thing that's interesting about that is when you draw a pyramid like that, I mean a triangle like that, and you actually connect the last dot on the altitude to the last dot on the base by drawing the line, which we call the hypotenuse, that line will have a very definite and very finite length. Now, you'll be able to see that, and you'll be able to experience it just by making the drawing.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about it is that when you calculate the length, it's never-ending. So,
yes.
You know, it teaches us that mathematics is a very useful tool, but it can't be taken literally because geometry is more fundamental than the math is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, this gives us some insights into the complexities of things that we take for granted. You know, you just say, oh, yeah, it's a circle. Well, or, oh, yeah, it's a cube. But things like that are not, oh, yeah. They're really complicated.
Well, conversely, if there was an entity in the fourth dimension or any dimension above that cared to create an inverted pyramid in space and within a three-dimensional reality, even though it may not be seen, the continuation of the line moving into the laws of three-dimensionality would produce a pyramid. sitting on the Earth, would it not?
Well, yeah, and there's a good example of the difference between perceptions in one in one set of dimensions versus the same set of perceptions in another. For instance, if we have, let's say we have a place called Flatland, which is essentially a two-dimensional world, and the people that live there are only have two dimensions. You know, they have height and width, but they have no thickness.
We could name it Washington, D.C., too, right? Never mind.
You're bound and determined to get me started.
Go ahead.
You know how I feel about that place.
It seemed that's what popped up in my consciousness when you said two dimensions, and that's being generous. So.
Yeah, it's actually being very generous.
Okay,
but
go ahead.
Anyway, for the sake of argument, the thing that's interesting about it. And people in Flatland, let's say, only have height and width.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could really mess up their day by drawing a square around them. Because there's no way they could get beyond it. We don't think about stuff like that, you know, but if there was such a place, the laws that pertain to it would be totally weird with respect to what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's interesting is if you drew the wall around it, and these people were watching this happen, they would be perceiving a three-dimensional creation interfering with their two-dimensional world, because a pencil that's drawing this line that can entrap these people is three-dimensional, and yet it's poking into their world, and it's having an effect of enormous ramification on their lives. Now, actually, the same thing happens to us, and we don't realize it.
Yeah.
We are three-dimensional beings, and if there are forces, beings, or geometries, for instance, which impinge upon our world from a higher plane of existence, they're beyond our perception, they're beyond our understanding. But yet they could greatly curtail or expand our experience in the 3D world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated with the ancient occult sciences.
Yeah.
It's because they knew this stuff and they made use of it. And here
mm-hmm.
we are today, you know, with all of this wonderful technology that we supposedly have at our disposal, and nobody has even an inkling of resurrecting knowledge from a much earlier period, which more than likely gave man the distinction of being able to communicate with a higher realm for the betterment of things.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we do today seems to be to tear down the elegance of the human experience and subjugate people to the whims of others.
It's yeah, the lower frequency.
It's a heck of a different situation altogether.
Yeah, don't you get the feeling it's as though people with the understanding or the reality of a fourth dimensional experience are constantly trying to drive our awareness into a two-dimensional framework, so that we don't at all experience the third dimension in its truest form, knowing that eventually that we will transcend into the fourth dimension or beyond that into the fifth dimension, and it's an individual issue with each person on this planet. It's not a general rule. So they exert great effort and great planning and forethought into various means to do that. Means that are called propaganda, mind control, brainwashing, whatever you want to say. But the constant badgering of the individual into a corner basically to separate them from the oneness of the all. And it's really, it's a sad state of affairs for those that do that, because there will be ramifications for those actions. For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. And that law would apply. That law would apply with what they're doing to humanity right now. And that's what is astounding is that in their great wisdom and the way they figure things out, they're totally ignorant of that. You know, it's something that one could actually feel sorry for these individuals that do that. And I have to avoid using the word people, because most of them are not people.
I have to agree with that in every sense of the word. But anyway, yes, and the thing that's interesting, too, is that they use geometry to achieve these ends.
Yes.
And that's something that people need to be conscious of. Now let's look at a given example of this. You know, you have a little baby born into a city like New York.
Mm-hmm.
And from infancy throughout life, what is he subjected to? Streets at right angles, you know, towering apartments and office buildings that create these canyons. And then, of course, there are spaces inside called offices and factories and other things of that sort, where they are forced to go every day to do something so that they can get a phony piece of paper that allows them to exchange that for something to eat or to pay rent so that they have a place to be sheltered. And we take all this for granted as a way of life without realizing how much thought went into the entire thing, because it conditions you and keeps you under a whole set of controls that we have come to interpret as life in the third dimension.
Yeah, but I call that frequency control, actually.
But actually, it's not life anymore.
Yeah.
Because the whole purpose of life is to have spontaneous and unplanned exchanges with other beings and other situations. And when you take all the spontaneity and the unknowns out of the equation, you're just an automaton. And
mm-hmm.
most people, you know, can't accept that, even though they're immersed in it. It's really amazing.
Yeah. I call what you're describing frequency control. And isn't it ironic that after they spend all day in one of those boxes, or let's say eight or 9 hours in one of those boxes, and maybe they take a break and they go feed themselves in another box, they go home and sit in a box looking at a box with images coming out of it. And images based upon illusion. And when you look at life as this unending pattern or this unending sequence of go into the big box that has a particular address, spend one third of your life there, go home and whatever time is left, spend whatever portion of that one third of that second one third of the day looking at another box that's inside the box, meaning the television. And then you're told that you must, to be a healthy, productive human being, you must spend a third of your life unconscious in what we call sleep. Now, some people actually have to subsist on that. I get by with 2 hours a day or 2 hours a night. And I know others that can do that. Maybe they need 3 or 4, 5 or 6, but I refuse to even consider sleeping a third of my life. That's definitely an indicator that they have the whole world under control for at least 8 hours of the day. So they only have to deal with what they feed you mentally, what thought forms they feed you, and what procedures you have to follow to control you for the other two thirds of your life. up until the point where you retire, right? And then the rest of it is waiting to die. So I hardly think that that's the purpose of life. That's the point I'm getting at.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And as a person who spent many, many years of his younger days in the wilderness, mountain climbing, exploring, hunting, doing all kinds of interesting things, I can tell you that when you make a comparison between the emotional and the psychic aspects of that other type of existence as compared to what people are subjected to in their daily routine, there is no comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only appreciate the difference if you go out there and do it.
Mm-hmm.
So like some of these people who spend their entire life in the city from cradle to grave, and they never really get out and rummage around in the wilderness or live off the land or do any of those kind of things. And God help us, some of them don't even get out of the state they were born in or the country they were born in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very far cry from what it means to be alive.
Oh, yes. You know, I've got an opinion about this concept of vacation. You see, when people earn the right to stop working for a couple of weeks, and possibly if they're in a vocation that allows them to get paid during that time period, they like to go someplace. And they like to go places where they experience the opposite of their daily routine. Their daily routine is involved in carrying out someone else's bidding. It's sometimes couched in under terms like marketing or manufacturing or administration or service. And so what do? They go to places and they stay in places where they can have the experience of someone else serving them. And they call that a vacation. They call that recuperation, or they call that re-energizing themselves. And it's really more the same thing. They're just putting another person in their place to do what they do the majority of their time, the other 50 weeks out of the year, for example. And so it's an illusion that really doesn't accomplish much in terms of one's expansion, other than maybe some people escape long enough that reality, that daily grind, and they think, you know, that's insane what I've been doing for the past 50 weeks. I'm going to change my vocation. So they go into a new vocation, and then at the end of 50 weeks, they get that same opportunity, and they say, well, the drinks were so great and the sun was so nice. And I'm not saying it's not interesting or exciting or rewarding to be in that situation, but an individual that is seeking creativity and awareness and insight is going to involve themselves in some other activity where they can express themselves freely. And I don't consider sitting on a beach waiting for the waiter to come and serve you a drink, the highest form of that activity. I don't know how you feel about that, but I think, you know, people they've bought in so much to these sequential patterns of behavior that to do anything else is considered, not to be in vogue. You know, everything is created for us. The opportunities are there, and we're reminded of those, and that's what you do if you're prestigious or if you're successful. And you could have a much more rewarding experience sitting in your backyard listening to the birds and watching the sun rise and watching it set and looking at the stars, or going out into nature, going camping, or doing some activity where you're still dependent upon your own skills, but you expand your awareness by doing something new and something totally unrelated to this sequence of pattern or the sequence of events that are predetermined for you before you even get there. Any comment about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. As a matter of fact, the thing that's interesting, and you touched on it earlier, about getting 2 to 4 hours of sleep as opposed to 8 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if you're literally unconscious for a third of your life, then the estimated American life expectancy of 70 years needs to be modified by two-thirds, because what good did the other one-third do you? You know, you're not around for it. You're mm-hmm. off in la-la land. Well, the thing that's interesting about that is that most people don't even have a refreshing night cycle or a sleep cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so stressed out by the way they're forced to live that they can't unwind. They'll watch TV, you know, hoping to relax or this or that, or else they'll pop some kind of a sleeping pill to go to sleep. And then when they reach the magic 8 hour mark, another little contraption goes off, makes a clamor of some sort that wakes them up. They drag their sorry behinds into the kitchen and load up on coffee so that they can stay awake for another 12-hour session. And the interesting thing is that when you live that way, which is the way most of us are forced to live, the sleep didn't do anything for you. Now, mm-hmm. when I was younger, I used to do a lot of meditation and a lot of yoga and martial arts and stuff of that nature. And I can tell you without the slightest hesitation that if you completely disconnect from your body under a controlled form of relaxation and meditation, you can get the equivalent of 10 hours of sleep in 3 hours, certainly in 4, and sometimes less. And you're all the better for it, not the worse for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why you can do that is because you've eliminated the stress, and instead of just drugging yourself into unconsciousness, you literally learn how to disconnect your spiritual component from the meat machine of your body and put everything into, you know, a very reduced metabolistic rate, so that true relaxation and rejuvenation can occur. And then when you decide to come back, a lot of times you can even remain conscious throughout the whole period, but your body has the same benefit as if you were asleep. And I spent years living that way with no ill effects that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Jim, let me ask you a question. And you know, I may have my own answer for this, and you and I always end up agreeing on most of what I say, or I agree with most of what you say. In fact, I don't have much that I think I've ever disagreed with, that you've said. If there are structures, if there are geometric structures that are conducive to healthier states of consciousness or healthier states of physiological growth or regeneration, then there must be some structures that have an adverse effect. Let's say living in a square room. Does that, you know, is to the best of your knowledge, do you think that that's the optimum shape? Would living in a dome maybe be healthier for us? Or certainly a pyramid would have its benefits. We don't have
well,
to have the sarcophagus.
That's actually a very interesting observation on your part, because back in the 60s, the Russians were really into this kind of stuff. And while America was poo-hooing it, they were investigating it very, very seriously. And this gal, Lynn Schroeder, wrote a book called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what year it came out in, but I have a copy of it back in New Jersey, and the thing that's interesting about that particular story, when they cover this one field called psychomics and psychomic generators, Russian investigators had found that certain shapes automatically lend themselves to all manner of activities, stuff that you wouldn't even imagine. Like, for instance, to train somebody for a psychokinesis or telekinesis, they actually came up with a very complicated shape. I'm not sure how they did it, but they came up with a shape that actually magnified the effect, so that when they hung this shape, let's say, on a rope or on a pulley or something, a person that was endeavoring to use their mind to move an object, we all apparently have this force. The problem is that it's so underdeveloped and it's so minuscule that if it ever does do something, we think it's a coincidence, or we dismiss it, you know, as having anything to do with us per se. And that's because of the fact that it's so microscopic in its overall effect. But with these psychomic generators, they were actually capable of taking an average individual off the street, giving him some basic instruction, sticking him in front of one of these units that was hanging on a string or something, and within a few minutes he was causing it to spin and bounce around. Well, once he becomes aware of this mechanism, then by feedback and practice, he can develop that. You know, here is another avenue that goes right in line with what we're talking about. God only knows what sort of capabilities the human mind is endowed with, but it's the way we're forced to live never allows us to experience those things, to make use of them, or to expound upon it. And, you know, it's very easy to shake your finger and say, oh, the Russians, the communists, this or that, you know, they're our enemy, they're no good. But those people were opening up vast areas of knowledge for the general good. And whatever came of that, we don't know. But it was never duplicated in this country, at least not openly. I mean, if some of that stuff was done, it was some black ops project somewhere, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question more thoroughly, I'm absolutely positive that not only do they have knowledge of the fact that certain shapes diminish the ability to expand consciousness, but can actually be used to suppress and play down your consciousness. I mean, just imagine if they could get you to the point where you're barely aware of what you are and what you need. I mean, that's great. And they have all these robots that are easily amused, fed with some garbage that's manufactured by Monsanto and entertained at night by television. They sleep 12 hours or 10 hours, and then they're woken up by an alarm clock and sent off to do some other task. Here they have this huge workforce. They're paying them with money that isn't money. It's just paper. And it's an amazing world, but not for the workers, only for the people who run the show.
Yeah. Now, I agree with what you're saying here, to take geometry maybe into another realm where, you know, we think of geometry as far as circles and triangles and spheres and rhomboids and trapezoids and various shapes, lines, of course, the components that make up all these different geometric shapes. But we also have geometric shapes that follow other types of patterns, different from those that we see, let's say, in physical objects. Let's take sound waves or light waves, for example. Now, light waves are susceptible, like sound waves, to all sorts of distortion and all sorts of interference, and are limited by amplitude and velocity and frequency. within their specific functions. Let's say if I play a musical instrument that's been designed to be heard, most things that have hearing can hear it. Now, even though a plant doesn't have visible ears, it can sense the vibration. And that vibration is another sort of geometric form. A sine wave, a sawtooth wave, square wave, triangle wave. Do you see a correlation between the use of those shapes and those frequencies and I know what you're going to say, but it's worth bringing this up anyway, to the expansion or the stifling of human consciousness?
Well, I mean, it's the same old story. Any of that stuff can be used in any direction that you want to use it in. It's just a question of are you willing to put in the time and the money to find out what the properties are that various frequencies and amplitudes and wavelengths offer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything has been investigated at least partially at some point or another. For instance, they've used sound as a weapon. They've used sound for medical purposes. They've used sound to bring about an amazing cooperation between the left and right hemispheres of the brain, which is a fascinating thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way they do that is very interesting. They'll put a set of headphones on you, and they'll put a frequency of, let's say, 60 cycles in one ear, and then they'll put a frequency of 61.5 cycles in the other ear.
Mm-hmm.
And one ear is governed by one side of the brain, the other ear is governed by the other side of the brain, and the cooperation between the two produces a beat frequency, which is a very low number, that will be actually created in the middle brain somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it forces the two halves of the brain to cooperate. So there's all kinds of things that have been done, and some are beneficial and some are of the opposite. But what you mentioned is ever so true. All of these things somehow interrelate. Now, if we had the time to go into it, I could go through a whole presentation that shows how the sine wave, the pure sine wave, has its origins in the geometry of a circle. And then all the other waves you mentioned, the square wave, the sawtooth wave, triangular wave, et cetera, are essentially combinations of various harmonics.
Mm-hmm.
of these waves. So actually, you wind up with situations where enormous quantities of the things that we have in our world are related back to some very fundamental things like circles, for instance. But the most interesting thing is that the circle in itself is a mystery, because it doesn't really exist the way we portray it in nature. And
mm-hmm.
the ancients knew this. As a matter of fact, what's really exciting is that their circle was governed by a number pi, which was essentially related back to phi. Now, in
mm-hmm.
the modern world, we don't do that. We say, well, you know, pi and e, which is the natural log base e, are numbers that fall into a special category called transcendental numbers. And the reason that they're special is because they are not the solution to any particular polynomial equation.
Yeah.
They're brought about by a series of geometric approximations.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is that doesn't mean that they're right.
Yeah.
Now, the reason that I'm enthralled with phi as being the true root of pi is because of the fact that everything in the universe, when you come right down to it, the genetics, the way plants are designed, the human body, But most particularly, it's obvious in the inspection of galaxies throughout the universe. The logarithmic spiral is
yes.
the overbearing master concept that makes everything work.
I was going to say, yeah. Go ahead.
And that is related directly to phi.
Yeah, I was going to say that a circle is nothing more than one portion of a spiral. You know,
that's right, and it's actually artificial because when you draw a circle, like on a piece of paper, for instance, okay,
mm-hmm.
your motions are forced because of the two-dimensionality of what you're doing
mm-hmm.
to produce a circle. But if you actually study the tip of the compass moving in three space, not the two space of the paper, you'll find that it makes a spiral because the area where you are when you start drawing the circle is no longer in the same place
mm-hmm.
when you complete the circle. And so it's actually an open structure. It's not a closed structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same with the planetary orbits, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, we teach our kids that, you know, each planet has an orbit that it's in, and it just goes around and around and around. Well, that's absolutely untrue. The star, our star, the sun, drags the planets behind it, and because of the fact that they're following their star, they never make a closed path. They make a series of spirals
mm-hmm.
as they go through space.
Well, now that raises another issue. I see, as a visual representation, I see a sine wave is an unraveled spiral that is constrained to a mean frequency. In other words, it rises and falls above that mean frequency, and it's been brought into more of a two-dimensional context, even though it can exhibit three-dimensional phenomenon. The rising and the falling is one aspect, and it can also move to the left or right. We always look at these things. We look at the representation of a sine wave seeing only one side of it. We don't see the other side, and we don't see if it deviates from side to side. A perfect sine wave, electronically produced, probably would stay along that line, that mean line, and follow that path. But in essence, if I took a sine wave at the frequency of a phi, it would go on forever, wouldn't it?
Sine wave has to go on forever by basic definition, and that in itself is a fascinating aspect that you just brought up, because when a person is in high school, for instance, and they're brought up to the board and the teacher says, you know, draw me a sine wave with a fundamental frequency of so many cycles per second or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
the kid gets up on the blackboard and he draws one cycle, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, he made an error because
yes.
that's not a sine wave.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, to produce that form of that one cycle would require an incredibly complex orchestration of harmonics.
Yes.
Whereas the pure sine wave, which is infinitely long by definition, is consisting only of one frequency. And so you get into all of these interesting ramifications of how the mathematics and the geometry of all these things create the reality that we take for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what's really happening.
Yeah, now, if I had been asked to draw that, I would have gotten out of school because I would have gone off the blackboard to the end of the room, through the doorway, and down the hall, and right out the door. And I'd have been writing on on the sidewalk, on the street. I'm just joking. But in essence, it would keep going on. And it wouldn't
yeah.
really change direction, would it? That perfect sine wave.
No, it wouldn't. But don't forget, no. Sine wave is an interesting animal because it's only part of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And this takes us into some of Tesla's work, which is really kind of fascinating. If
yeah.
you take a spring, for instance, which is a helix,
mm-hmm.
and you shine a light through the spring, and you project a shadow from the spring down onto a piece of white paper, when you tip that spring at a certain angle, you're going to see a sine wave on that paper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the interesting thing about it is that little experiment demonstrates the fact that in reality, a sine wave is only a part of what's available. And this is where Tesla tried to teach people, the same was true in the electrical world, the sine wave is usually associated with a transverse wave component. And but the true form that electrical power takes when you unleash it in its totality is a spiral that projects in a particular direction.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for that to happen, you have to have another component, and that component is the longitudinal component. And this is the one that everybody says, well, yeah, there are longitudinal waves in physics, but you can't produce them in electricity. And Tesla said, well, okay, that's fine. You don't have to make them. I'll take care of it. And so he went on and developed all this new technology based on the proper cooperation or intercooperation between, you know, the transverse and the longitudinal waveform, and he was able to transmit power all over the world without wires and to do all sorts of amazing things, which nobody else can do because they ignore one half of the entire science, and then they've got the audacity to say, well, he was senile. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that, and then there's the old method of attacking the person, you see. Instead of seeking to understand and, or, you know, learn and become aware of those principles, they attack the person that made the discovery.
Well, it's easier.
Yeah, well, it's a scapegoat for those that have to admit that they're not as smart as they'd like everyone to think they are.
Exactly.
you know, and I'm not going to go off on a rant with that, but that's, you know, I get email from people who are, pseudoscientists coming up with all kinds of equations as to why, the true purpose for the towers collapsing on 9/11. My response to that person is, how does your equation explain the fact that the BBC reported the destruction of WTC-7, the third building to fall, 24 minutes before it happened? Why were they reporting that? Did they have your scientific equation? You know, I mean, people can't think outside the box anymore, and people will, to the death, argue this archaic or this really blasphemous type of pseudoscience that they picked up in some textbook somewhere. You know, there are some brilliant scientists out there. I'm not attacking science in general, but these people that come up with these idiotic explanations for simple things. You know, those buildings didn't have jet fuel in them, okay? So the story, it in and of itself, is a ruse. That makes the equation a ruse. And this guy is describing temperatures in the 34 and 40,000 degree area. Is the reason this building fell. You know, it's insane. And then people say, oh, it gets tiresome explaining this to people that want to talk about conspiracies. A conspiracy is what it is. The science is what it is. And the truth is what it is. And I see in many cases, and I say, when I say the science misapplied, the science using superstition as a basis for its reality, or the method of attack of the messenger bringing forth new knowledge and wisdom and insight and awareness. You know, see, I can go on a rant too, and I'm not a scientist, but I resent the people out there that think that they have all the answers because they went to some school and got a piece of paper saying that they went to that school. I see some of the most idiotic decisions ever made on this planet right now being made by people in positions of power that have no right to be where they are. other than they're playing a game of illusion. So that's my rant.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and I agree with it. But let me jump back to where I was,
yeah.
Just because we can step off now to a lot of interesting places, having laid those prior foundations. The first thing I'd like to mention is the fact that, just like the Tesla magnifying transmitter worked on essentially a spiral displacement, the Dynaflux alternator, which you're so fond of, actually operates on the basis of a of an elliptical displacement.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all of these things happen because of the fact that when you understand the geometry in three space and you look at how it's going to be projected into the next level down, you see how these forces are brought to bear and what the ramifications are of using it. So if you're willing to do that and think it through with a particular goal in mind, you can then make things happen that look miraculous. But the thing that's interesting is that the opposite is also true. If you insist on adhering to the status quo, you really can't be so stupid as to expect new results, because you've already defined your set of options.
Mm-hmm.
So if you define your set of options and say, well, I'm staying within these limitations, don't be surprised if you come up with the same old stuff over and over again, because you're the one who decided to do it that way.
Yeah. Well, we've got to wrap the show, Jim, but I do want to add one final comment, and that also applies to solving problems and getting to the truth about a lot of really important issues, which is more the same bunk, just expressed in or not expressed in another way. I would entertain going into the topic that you proposed about sound, if you care to, next week. I think that would be really interesting, and I'd like to touch on as many aspects of that as possible, you know, in the course of our interview. So, you know, it's a wide open slate. If you chose,
well, we could certainly do that, and. The other thing was that I still had another section or so here that we could have covered, which would pertain to how the spiral movements in the galaxy actually are related to vortexes, and how that's the basis of all creation, and then that leads into all these so-called free energy and other areas of which sound can be one.
Yeah, well, it's going to have to wait till next week, you know, it's been interesting, and certainly we can lead off with that next week, and touch upon that before we go into any other further discussion. How would that be?
That will be just fine, and I will keep my information hot and ready for you.
Okay. I want to thank you, Jim, for being on the show again, as usual. And look forward to next week's interview. In the meantime, we've got to say goodnight to our listening audience. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I understand there may have been some streaming problems tonight. Hopefully we got them resolved. If we didn't, you can always catch the show on the archives at bbsradio.com. I want to give special thanks to Doug and Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick for the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us again next week. We've got another set of great guests lined up for you, some great topics, important topics, pertinent topics, and be sure to tune in. Tell your friends about it also. In the meantime, I would like to thank the listening audience for tuning in, and have a great weekend. Have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.